This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. I'm Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living, and this is our radio show, Reality Sandwich. I have with us today our co-host, Camila Aguilar, who is the moderator of Studio B, a community space, and she is an expert. She's an expert in permaculture and the interconnectedness of people and sustainable living and all those wonderful things. So we have her on as our co-host, and she has brought a guest, Richard Register. So firstly, hello, Camila.
Hi.
You want to go ahead and introduce our guest for the day?
Love to. Today we have Richard Register, who I would probably more likely assume an expert than I would ever assume to be on the subject. I'm a networker primarily, and one of the greatest values to wanting to develop community is the idea of really being able to re-envision our future, understanding that our place on the planet really is going to be ensured by the communities we build, by the interconnectedness, by the cooperation, and basically re-establishing human values as opposed to profit and object values. Richard, I've invited today on the show because he's been working for decades now around the idea of revisioning cities that would enable these values of bringing human back into human existence. So welcome, Richard. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, welcome. It's a subject that doesn't get really talked about a lot. We were talking before the show. We're always talking about the small things or the, you know, should we do solar power? Should we do wind power? Should we do car? But we're not really looking at the primary structure of our main way of living together and how that can have even a more significant impact, or at least maybe be a place to start a foundation to then create other ways of also being more efficient and working with nature. So how did you get involved in all of this?
Well, I became interested in cities, I guess, because I, many things. I've lived in them my whole life, actually. But I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which was a traditional pedestrian city for hundreds of years, second oldest city in the country. And a very graceful place until rather recently. I think it's become overly commercialized and rich and tourist-oriented and so on. But it's a beautiful place to grow up, and the natural environment there is actually very spectacular, beautiful place. So I grew up interested in general in the city that I was in, and only realized as time went on that cities have become very dominated by automobiles. In your first comments there, you were talking about looking at the larger situation. And an interesting experience for me was to go to South Africa recently to the World Summit on Sustainable Development. And here they were talking about development, but we're not looking at the fact that the city is the largest thing human beings develop. Mm-hmm. And I began to become aware that we're building them for automobiles a long time ago, reading Lewis Mumford and other critics of the modern era, and getting to meet Paolo Soleri, an architect from Italy originally, who is saying that we're basically building cities for cars instead of people. We are building cities that are scattered out and very flat as compared to three-dimensional, like normal, complex living organisms. And so if you have this gigantic contradiction at the core, which is you try to take a complex functioning entity that you're actually building, you're actually developing the city, and you try to make it thin like a sheet of paper, and then you see all these this vascular system tied up in the knots of freeway interchanges and great big dead zones called parking lots and so on developing all over the landscape, you begin to realize that you're building something that's probably not sustainable. And I started to catch on to some of this back in the 1960s, even when I did meet Paolo Soleri and started thinking about the more compact city. And it's meant a lot to me ever since then, because partially, I guess, I'm a sculptor. I like making three-dimensional objects. And so the idea of making three-dimensional habitats for people to live in other words, somewhat taller buildings, and making them beautiful and bringing nature back into them and so on, struck me as a very exciting and positive thing to do. And rather more recently, the negative aspects of why to do that have become more predominant because we're getting closer and closer to the era when we're going to start running out of cheap, or we actually have run out of cheap energy. People don't really notice it quite yet. It once was fairly cheap, but now it's subsidized by wars in the Middle East, by free money going to freeway interchanges instead of going to Amtrak. We are building something that is very, very damaging and can't last. Nowadays, you look at climate change and you begin to see that the city of sprawl is the major cause of it. You want to do something about that. So I started thinking, gee, this will be fun to develop beautiful ecological cities. And nowadays, I find myself, not that I really like to do this, having to talk a lot about the damage that results when you don't look at nature and when you don't build a city for people. And New Orleans is a perfect example for that. Mm-hmm. Everything you could have learned for nature that we learned 5,000 years ago when the first cities were built along waterways and rivers and coastlines, we have forgotten. In Samaria and in the Indian cities that were only a little bit more recent than that, almost 5,000 years old, they built on platforms. They actually would create fill, build up the city just a few feet, floods would come, the water would go around the city. You can't do that when you have a city that's built for cars because it covers far, far too much land. You can't move that kind of earth. But you could with pedestrian cities. You can work much more easily with nature if you do that. So what morphed from a very positive thing for me to do when I was young and enthusiastic about, you know, building the ideal city has become almost a defensive action of trying to save what's left of nature as quickly as we can by redesigning the cities. And I have to say, both approaches have not been received well in our society. But we don't have much time left to think about those approaches and do something about it. Things are getting bad very rapidly now.
Well, Richard, I want to introduce the book you published because this I find such an amazing compendium of the whole idea of city. There are many people who agree with you that we have environmental disaster, but their answers are mostly pointed toward let's get out to the country and start the ideal community and go in, forget all about it. And your approach is, no, let's address the city and accept it as a natural outgrowth of human existence and revision the city to go back to something more sustainable. And you have articles in this book. It's called, by the way, Village Wisdom, Future Cities, and it's incredibly poetic and informative and inspiring, so I wanted to give that some word there. One of the relationships that you make very clear, or other contributors to the book, is that density is sort of at the heart of a healthy city where the center is not car-oriented but pedestrian-oriented. And this is such a foreign view. I mean, it exists more in foreign cultures than it does here in America. And so I can see that this is a difficult thing to get across to people. Like, why would we want to get rid of parking lots and cars and that sort of thing? And this is one of those pivotal changes that needs to happen within the minds of people. It seems like what we're really needing is an educational groundwork to enable the changes that you're suggesting. Because everything you're saying is common sense. You think we'd all be on board and just going gung-ho for it, and wouldn't it be fun? But I imagine you've encountered a lot of probably analyzed it pretty well, what the major obstacles are for getting city planning to embrace the ideas that you have.
One of the major obstacles is what you might think of as neighborhood conservatism. People buy into the neighborhood and want to keep it that way, as close to that way as they can deep into the future. They don't want to see any new density. Well, it's not really true, by the way, that in America we don't have dense areas that work really well. We're in San Francisco right now, for example, and I live in downtown Oakland, and I can walk anywhere, get almost anything done, came over on BART, and so on. So you can find places that work enormously well in the United States right now, though it is a minority phenomenon. The vast majority is automobile-oriented. And I've been to China 4 times in the last 5 years, and it's terrifying how fast they're developing over there. And they do a lot of density, but they also do a lot of car dependence. They do a lot of gigantic city infrastructure that's very uniform, very much office over here, enormous campus over there, massive housing over here, scattered at fairly great distances one from another. And this is the kind of thinking that I think has to change, or we're in really serious trouble.
Or at least to, with that kind of scattering, keep coming back to the model that I believe it's in Brazil. There is a city, Curitiba, that
Curitiba, Brazil.
Sounds just phenomenal in how they've understood that light rail as a way of creating many villages within a larger city and having that nodal kind of interconnectedness where it's easy for people to have pedestrian malls at the ends of these light rail. And so you can have cities have clusters of densities. Mm. And it just seems like a mindset that needs to be reintroduced. And also what the person speaking about this city said is that there is a strong educational foundation that enabled citizen participation with the government. And I'm just wondering how you view that possibility happening here, getting civilians behind government to try to create some changes.
Well, I think people have to, the environmentalists, I think, are a good lead-in onto that discussion because they have decided they want to do something because of the greater good, like saving the whales or the redwood trees or the like. In other words, they've come up with a moral decision based on something they think is going on in nature that's a serious problem. And they say, well, we got to deal with this. And so they do in their own way. And I think they're making some serious mistakes, for example, right now promoting energy-efficient cars, which will only promote further expansion of sprawl as far as I can see. So mm-hmm. I think if you don't look to reshaping the whole city in the first place, you're making a serious mistake. But what they have going for them that I think is absolutely indispensable is this conscientious response to what's going on the planet right now and saying, look, we have to start doing something about that. And some of them are changing their lives personally, too, like insisting on riding bicycles when they could well drive someplace and consuming less and recycling more and so on. And those things, I think, are all very important to do. But I think you have to look at some very large, serious problems and start thinking, well, the way I live, the people I vote for, the ordinances I favor that I'm going to vote for or against and so on in my city, they mean something. And then you start thinking, well, you know, only 1 out of 12 people on this planet has a car. If I always sort of illustrate this to myself by holding up my fingers, you know, that's only 1 out of 12. You have put all your fingers up once, then you put 2 more fingers up, and only one of those has a car. And those people, that 8% on the entire planet is responsible for most of the climate change, most of the extinction of species. This is an insane thing to think we can make cars better. Mm-hmm. We have to make the whole city better. We have to make the home that we live in, the home that is our constructed home, as well as the home that's the planet, harmonious with each other. We're not going to make it. We've lost all that 35 years ago opportunity for the positive enthusiasm that I had that was saying, let's vigorously build something that's totally wonderful. Well, you have people in the neighborhoods that don't want to change anything. They don't mm-hmm. want to change the density. Well, look back to the environmentalist who says, we have to really change something because there's something going on the larger scale here that is very, very frightening. I used to say, I'm an artist, I make sculpture, I really love that sort of stuff. It can be beautiful, let's build beautiful stuff. Never got any funding for it. Still don't get any funding for the negative approach either. But the fact is, you have to do something now because we're deep into climate change. The situation with Katrina howling into New Orleans and smashing that place to pieces while people were not paying attention to the way people should build in that kind of a location. It's, what could be more obvious as a lesson from that? And yet no one's learning that, no one's saying that. Why did Katrina happen? Because we built sprawl. Mm. It was probably a Category 4 instead of a Category 2 hurricane because the climate is getting hotter. The temperature of the surface of the Gulf was 90 degrees.
Wow.
That's how hot the water was under that hurricane. Now, there's so many points of entry in the discussion of the subject that it's kind of amazing, but that's one to really think about.
You were talking about diversity of the city. Earlier you were talking about downtown and how typical downtowns are tall buildings and there's not really a lot of people living there. And then you have another section where people are living. The advantage of kind of diversity in a city where you've got offices and people living in, is that specifically, what's the purpose of that for people that aren't aware? Is that to allow so cars aren't needed, or what is that diversity both on a city level and then inside a building? You were talking about that too. Can explain this diversity and the benefit of that for cities.
Okay. Well, you can look at it very personally. For example, in my own life, I live in downtown Oakland. And I can walk to cafes, several of them in a short distance, and restaurants and BART and hardware store and bank and music store. Just everything is very close. There's a park. There's a wonderful lake. There's water. Many things are available. Now, if you live in the suburbs, how do you get all of that?
Drive.
Well, you drive everywhere. And so that means something. It means that in the metropolis area, in a metropolitan area, you can look at the way things are happening. There's the largely single-use downtown, the business district, which could have more people living there. Some of the businesses could move out, and some have, into the suburb, but they usually move into a situation where everybody is driving nonetheless. But the suburbs themselves could find their centers and become new towns in their own right, and the pedestrian areas within these centers are what would make them really livable.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense.
It also sounds like there could be a lot of economic incentive for revisioning cities with the idea that as petroleum becomes more and more expensive, suburbs will become less ideal places to be, which means people will start migrating in closer. And if we don't have the infrastructure established, it's going to come about in a really hodgepodge way. It seems like it's such common sense what the ideas that you're thinking of. It really seems like a failing within industry to see and envision the future and understand just even monetary or economically that there is opportunity and the necessity for change, that there always is. And again, because I'm so oriented around community, I'm always thinking about how is it that we bring the needs of people together and relate to one another in terms of need, because from that place, it does become a creative challenge as opposed to, oh, the sky is falling. Like, as soon as we say climate change, most people get that kind of glazed look in their eyes. It's hard to motivate people around the really big stuff. But if we can find ways of connecting need and ability, it's like a garden. It's about being able to create a nurturing environment, and I find that again and again the most effective way of bringing people together.
Can I share a story?
Sure. Yeah, let me hand this to you.
This is Amy. My name's Amy. I'm a friend of Julie's, and I've been interested in this idea of city organization and permaculture issues and rethinking the way we're living for a long time. And the story that comes to mind is just on the tale of what Camila was sharing, because I'm a new mom. I have a 2-year-old, and I live in Palo Alto, which has that kind of city center and a certain density and a diversity to it. And I found it so important to be able to just stick him in the stroller and be able to walk everywhere, as opposed to getting all the things together, getting in the car, getting over to that. And it made my way of life so much easier, as well as rich, as well as educational for him, to be able to see all this like multiplicity of ideas and people and activity all going on at the same time. So I feel like people see these concepts as a limiting to their life. Like, oh, I have to give up all these things. I have to change. I have to withdraw in some way. But in reality, when you step into it, you find this sparkling life set out in front of you, which is just, it's amazing when you start making these changes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's just what I wanted to offer as a perspective on these views of changing the way we're living. So,
yeah. I think those observations are very true, and there is room for a certain number of people to make that kind of transition in the infrastructure we have now, but if we don't start building a different sort of infrastructure rather rapidly, our numbers, and I count myself in those numbers, are rather limited, because the suburbs aren't finding their centers very well right now. There's a movement in that direction. The new urbanists and people that talk about smart growth are promoting more transit villages on nodes where you can get to by rail and so on. That's a good start. But we need to move much more quickly than we've seen, and we need to think in terms, I think, also of removing development in the wrong place before people will get the concept that we're shifting the density in a way that we can actually design and build. And one tool to do that is called a transfer of development rights, which I think is very powerful. And with this, South Lake Tahoe has removed 140 houses that were on the side of the lake and upstream a little bit that were shedding lots of water and causing silt to go into Lake Tahoe. And, of course, they prize their clear waters up there for tourists and for retirement and so on. So they wanted to come up with a system by which they would remove the buildings that were in the wrong place and shift them somewhere else in the more urban areas along the side of the lake where they could control the runoff better and where the people would be able to walk places instead of having to drive places. So these houses that were built in the 1960s that were large one-story ranch houses and driveways and sidewalks and streets going all over the place have been removed, 140 of them. And the developers have taken that density and put them elsewhere in the more urban areas there. It's a very good model. To augment that, you could do things to the particular buildings that make them much more livable. For example, in Berkeley, I lived for 2 years in a building that I managed to talk the developer into remodeling with rooftop gardens and terracing and public spaces on the top, and we called it a live roof as compared to the sort of dead ones you see that are nothing but a flat slab of asphalt or shingles or something. Instead, this roof is full of life, has a wonderful view of the bay with the sparkling water. I could watch the sunsets over the bay for the first time in my 30 years of living in Berkeley because I was up 9 stories in the air. And then I could just pop down the elevator, and within a few seconds, literally seconds, I'd be in the middle of my cultural life and have almost every option you can imagine for a city within about 3 or 4 blocks, plus transit to elsewhere in the region. So that's not a bad way to live and to design the building so that you do have those features like the views and the accessibility on top and the terracing and the vines and the trellises and so on makes them really fun. People get married up there. It's an elegant, beautiful view of the town. And so if you can put together the density and all those advantages of having the diversity has to be there with the density or it doesn't really work. But if you have both the density and the diversity simultaneously in these areas that could become pedestrian, then those can become very powerful visions of where we might be going. Unfortunately, even in Berkeley, there's an enormous amount of resistance to augmenting the development in the centers of the neighborhoods. And in the downtown, there are architectural conservatives that say we don't want anything over 2 stories in the neighborhood centers. We don't want anything over 5 stories in 95% of the downtown. If we can't shake that up and make higher density really livable and beautiful, then we have a really serious problem because we won't have room for people like, is your name Amy? For Amy, except for the few of us that are in that position already to push our babies, you know, down a sidewalk without a lot of interference for cars. There's just not that much infrastructure available.
You know, I love living in the city, and similar to Amy, I was just I see other family members of mine that don't live in the city and how they have to just to go, oh, I need some milk. They have to get in the car. They have to drive. Now, granted, they don't have to do any exercise. They walk 12 feet from the kitchen to the garage and then from the parking lot to the store. So that's cushy for them. But it's a pain, in my opinion, to have to go through all that hassle to get milk. I walk down. I have to walk a block and a half, you know, so there's a little exercise involved. And sometimes it is kind of, I don't really feel like doing any walking, but 95% of the time it is a much more convenient opportunity to live in the city. So I personally love the city. But the question I have, I'm not highly experienced in this area, so this might be a very naive question, but what happened in the old days? You had a city like San Francisco, but there was a place to grow food, right? So you didn't have to ship it from 400 miles away.
Right.
How would something like that work now if we wanted to bring back those cities? Where would we grow food?
Well, the interesting thing is that the European city takes up about 1/4 as much land as the average American sprawly city, which means that 3/4 of what's now paved over could be, as you were saying, permaculture gardens and community gardens that produce food. I work at a community garden on the border of Berkeley and Albany, for example. We have fruit trees, and we get food out of that location. We restored a creek there. It used to be buried underground. It's really a wonderful little project. It's a very little project, but lurking under 3/4 of the asphalt is what could be natural and agricultural landscape. just going to the kind of densities they have in Europe without the ecological design features I've mentioned, like solar greenhouses on the sunny side of the building, rooftop gardens and trellises and vines, for largely for decoration, but to bring in native species again, you can do that. You can have hummingbirds visiting your downtowns, and they do visit. There were plenty of hummingbirds at the house the 9-story building I was in downtown Berkeley. Hmm. I just put the plants out there and they show up. So the food growing can be a renaissance in the cities. But you have to figure out how you're actually going to move people out. This will be a challenge, by the way, in seeing what's going to happen in New Orleans, because an awful lot of that should not have been built in the manner that it was built at all. And as in the fire zone, the Berkeley-Oakland Hills fire of, I think it was 1989, 30% of the people didn't want to return after the catastrophic thing they'd been through. And yet the insurance laws, the insurance agreements, said they had to rebuild on the same spot. That's a very bad idea. Mm. They should be able to take their money and go wherever they want. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have 30% of the people who are in a location was dangerous in the first place, car dependent in the second place, if they want to go somewhere else, why don't you let them move somewhere else? Mm-hmm. And so in some situations, you could plan into the future so that you could actually open up landscapes with transfer development rights, as I've described a minute ago, or with mitigation money from a project that's going up that's going to have, say, a fair amount of water discharge into the rivers, and so they're required to restore a creek somewhere. Well, let them buy some houses that are in the wrong place if people want to sell. But the zoning is such that you can't do that now, and you don't have the institutions established to actually allow transfer development rights to work. So there are many, many steps, many things that can be done. They're all very particular. There's wonderful models all over the world.
I'd like to build on that a little. One of the wonderful things about this book, why it's so hope-engendering, is because it mentions so many of the models that are existing. It was published 8 years ago, and what I got from reading the book was, wow, there's a lot more going on than our media ever lets us know about. And this is what creates hope, instead of that pie in the sky, oh, we've got this big problem and we should start thinking about it, but it's so large we go limp. And here it creates a model network, because it's happening all over the place. What is happening now? Like, how far do you view in the last 8 years have we globally evolved around thinking about cities? Because it seems, and also, is there any kind of documentation, films or something like this, just to be able to get this message out to more people? Because I think this is the sort of thing that sparks engagement. When people know what's possible, you can get a lot more followers on than if you ask everyone to kind of, you know, conceptualize from scratch.
Well, there are very good models all over the world, as I've been saying. Looked at in total, however, the rush to more rationalizing for cheap energy. You know, people don't say, let's have less energy. They say, well, let's go to some other form of energy as we're approaching running out of oil, or not running out, but running more and more scarce in the production of oil. Less oil is going to be produced fairly soon now. They call that phenomenon peak oil. You go over the peak production, you start down the other side. But there's no way the demand is going to go down. It's going to continue racing upward.
It is racing upward.
My experience in India and China says, you know, that's just what you can depend on, and yet the energy source is going to start dropping. The convenient energy source, the one that has been cheap, and all the rest are very expensive and even more damaging when you get into them. So on balance, though, that book, Village Wisdom Future Cities, records many wonderful things that were going on 8 years ago. And by the way, that came out of a conference in West Africa, the third International Eco-City Conference. And we had one in Curitiba, Brazil, which is a very good model city for many aspects of ecological cities. We had another one in China, in Shenzhen, in the year 2002, and the next one will probably be in Bangalore, India. We have a host there that's trying to get it organized. But in any case, I have to say that we've been solving lots of small environmental problems, but the really big ones are getting much worse all the time. You talk about how nice it is, how really inspiring it is, and I agree. I'm inspired by the positive things that I see and write about all the time. I don't know what it is about so many people. It is so hard to get any support for putting these ideas forward. Our group has virtually zero foundation support. We have a small number of members. We can't seem to get more members. People just aren't responding for some reason to the ecological city message very well yet. And I don't know if the coming crises will make them lock down even harder and be more afraid of the positive alternatives or not. When I became involved in the all the things that were going on after the firestorm in the Oakland, Berkeley Hills, and 3,375 homes were destroyed. That's a lot. And there were a lot of workshops about how to rebuild and so on. And I suggested, well, why don't we have a center up there in the hills around the area where Hiller Highlands is located, which has absolutely spectacular views. 30% of the people want out of the deal. Well, you consolidate some of the open space in the periphery. You would buy up some of the property towards the center. You would create a public plaza. You'd have higher density in this one area. You'd surround a beautiful plaza with a view out over the Golden Gate that would be absolutely spectacular. It'd be a wonderful little tourist destination. There'd be enough density up there for a streetcar stop coming up Broadway and Broadway Terrace. It could terminate there in a wonderful European-like city center, which could also have rooftop gardens and solar greenhouses on the south side and so on. And it would not sell at all. And one of the reasons is that in a crisis situation, many people go very conservative. They want to fall back on what they think is dependable. And instead of having a more open mind, they actually get more rigid. So I'm always in this position of saying to myself, well, can I feature the crises that are really coming up, like peak oil and global climate change and species extinction, as one of the reasons to be interested in redesigning the cities? Will that work? Well, it doesn't seem to. It doesn't seem to, I mean, I'm being really honest with you now, it doesn't seem to work that well to present all the positive things about these alternatives. The book which you like there is a total, I hate to say it, financial disaster. We lost $35,000 on that book. And yet it's stuffed with wonderful information. So I honestly do not know how to communicate these things. I spend a lot of my time communicating about it. A lot of people go, oh, that's nice. But somehow it doesn't magnify. It doesn't suddenly become the rage or the style or the guidelines, the guidance for city councils, for people when they join organizations. There are 30,000 people in the East Bay are in the member of the Sierra Club, and we have about 20 in our organization that are dues-paying members. Now, something's weird about that in my mind, and it may just be me, that I haven't figured out how to do something obvious, you know. But with such a positive, holistic vision that is very honest, that looks at the way the big things are moving, that looks at the way particular lives are improved in a very personal way by living in car-free areas, by taking part in your community gardens, by bicycling instead of driving your fat tail end around all the time in a gigantic SUV. You know, all these things make sense. Why don't they come together so that we actually are building these things all over the world right now? I don't know. They're building some things. You know, there's a little bit of progress. There's the new urbanists that do some interesting things. There's, you know, some cities that are greening their rooftops, but it's a minority phenomenon.
I'm going to venture a guess at your questions why. The minority phenomena is a natural outgrowth of anything that's future-minded. We're artists, and so we tend to see the future just like the back of our hands. But for most people, that's why some people identify as being artists and some people don't. I believe we all, in our hearts, are artists, but some people forgot at birth. Somehow amnesia sets in, and a lot of us walk around not being able to see much beyond how to provide for our basic survival. And people frequently, as you said, they tend to go conservative when they're worried about survival. A firestorm happens. They don't think about great possibilities. They're thinking about, oh, my God, I almost lost it. You know, good thing we had the insurance, and the insurance says we've got to do it this way. Okay, we're, you know, end of story. I still really feel that there's a lot to learn from the marketing industry, that why are corporations so dominant on the planet? Because their PR is so down. You know, people have really been conditioned to see the world a certain way because marketing understands psychology and how people plug into getting their needs met, even plugging into things that are not really meeting their real needs, these assumed needs that have been force-fed into them. I think that we in the environmental, permacultural, visionary realm need to learn something from those industries that are promoting things that are not good for humans and instead instill on a more broad scale education, communication, entertainment, you know, and engage other artists to be part of connecting with people and invigorating our sense of life. It's really what we're talking about. We've been divided and conquered by highways and streets.
Well, I think the entertainment and the fun and the excitement and the beauty of the potential alternatives is really wonderful. But what is odd to me is how so many people can spend so much of their time doing things that seem so bizarrely irrelevant and uninteresting in their entirety in my own mind. I might be just completely off here, but how can anybody watch television for several hours a day or watch it at all? I don't even have a television set. There's so many exciting things to be doing. There's so many, you talk about needs. What are the real needs? The real needs are shelter, food, rest, you know, a few very, very basic things. And yet, you have people that are spending inordinate amounts of time watching sports, playing with ridiculous toys with their kids, like these electronically controlled radio little cars that go smashing around on sidewalks and things, that are very, very expensive, wasting inordinate amounts of time in front of the computer playing various kinds of games while the whole world's going down the drain. And so here you have people that are taking the easy way out, and because of that, I'm quite suspicious that following the marketing people and the advertisers is going to give us much, because I think they're actually preying upon weaknesses in human character in some way that to me seems very destructive. Could actually be sitting there letting their lives be drained away by the superfluous activity when there's wonderful rewarding things to be done in gardening and restoration of living things and building beautiful buildings and redesigning bicycles, you know, because they're going to go down your bicycle paths through greenways. You know, all these things seem to me relevant to what you've been talking about as needs.
Mm-hmm. And we know that.
Mm-hmm.
But
what I'm saying is the advertising industry and the marketing does not deal with needs. It deals with dreams.
Well, they're prescribed needs. And what we need to do is reassume ownership of the commons. And the advertising space that's being used to enforce unnecessary needs on people to the point that people don't recognize their own needs.
Yeah, manufactured needs.
Manufactured needs. We need to come up, you know, speak a language people understand. People understand advertising, sound bites, entertainment, but come at it with the approach of reconnecting people to what's really going on inside as opposed to that constant pursuit for what's outside. Mm-hmm. Always having to consume just beyond their reach, just beyond their monetary capacity, just deeply, deeply reaching into permanent debt is really what we've created with this division amongst people, because we're also, as Julie was describing, the get in your car, do very little exercise, communicate with no one, go to the store where the cash register beeps at you so you can't even talk to the cashier. All of this, you know, we've all been divided and conquered by our technology, and it's time to use the language that has evolved and use it to turn people back into thinking, feeling, hearing their own voice kind of people.
I completely agree. The challenge is how do we do that? Because people are so absorbed in this programming that they've received and this go, go, go. We've got to accomplish all these mindless things or these unimportant things. So they're not able to just sit and be because it's uncomfortable, because they know there's some discrepancy in what their heart and soul really tells them and what they are pursuing on a daily, monthly basis. And, I don't have an answer to that, but maybe Amy.
Well, no, I don't have an answer either, but I was just going to offer another observation that, you know, we talk about people going into conservatism when they're in crisis, and most people I know always have a crisis going on in their life, whether it's environmental, whether it's health related, whether it's family related, work related, moving. Something is always occupying that level of fear and am I going to be okay and am I going to survive and is my family going to survive? And so there's, I think that, you know, our country feels like it's under attack and it's under threat, you know, from so many different from angles. And so when people are constantly inundated with fear messaging from these various outside sources, as well as this interior fear that's happening just like in their own lives, they shut down, like what you're saying. And so it becomes very difficult to think about making changes because you're just kind of trying to hold steady for things to get okay. So it's such a complex problem, not only on the interior, but dealing with the levels of bureaucracy and all the different forces and groups that have to come together to create these visions of interconnectedness and multi-layered systems and questions about ownership. I mean, it's an amazing problem.
Well, I think part of the solution is simply to understand there is a vision in shifting the density of the city back to something that's more pedestrian and more focused and more diverse structure. Without that vision, you don't have much order, and it looks like a chaos out there. But if you actually can see what needs to be built, then you have some direction in which to go. And very few people have that so-called vision or have the insights to to actually know what to vote for example, when it comes up before an election, who to vote for city council, what they really stand for. And most people aren't aware that it could be very, very wonderful environment to have something that's much more pedestrian-oriented, that's something that lets nature come back into it. They just simply haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, well, the subject's far too big. We can't do anything about the city. The city is gigantic. You know, somebody has to do it for us, some expert coming in from somewhere else. And by the way, I'm not exactly an expert. I have no degrees. I'm sort of, you know, self-educated from the streets. I was an artist from early in my life. I dropped out maybe too early. I don't know. But in any case, I write books on the subject of ecological design, et cetera. But, you know, I'm no expert. And there are, though, the ideas that can come together to actually give you some kind of direction to go. And I don't think many people have that.
Can you tell us some examples of successes that have happened in the eco-city arena? How have successes happened? Was there a mindset? Was there a particular outlook from those people? What has been successful in making some changes happen?
It's an interesting way of putting the question, too, to say how did the change come about, and not just the change itself. Curitiba, Brazil is an interesting example because it came about in a rather authoritarian way. The dictators were in control, and they didn't want another potential dictator to become mayor of Curitiba. And so they were casting about, and they thought, well, let's put an architect in charge who's interested in the infrastructure. And so they selected a guy named Jamie Lerner, who rather reluctantly took the job, but he wanted to focus on the architecture and the city planning, and he did. And so he said, well, we all have been studying European examples here, and we have the horrible example right next door, about 200 miles away, of Sao Paulo, which was just a gigantic city that was just coming to pieces, full of pollution, traffic jams like crazy, back in 1972 when Jaime Lerner was appointed to be mayor. He and some other people at the newly formed architecture school liked European pedestrian areas. They said, let's do some pedestrian areas and let's start thinking about public transit. And by the way, they were busy industrializing farming at that point in Brazil history, and so they knew there were going to be many, many more people coming into the city from farms. They're going to be displaced by agriculture, by high-powered agriculture. And so they knew they were going to be expanding, so they said, well, let's start this off by dedicating 5 bus lines that are for buses only, dedicated lines that reach out from a pedestrian center of the city. And so they got the land use pedestrian and transit aspects of the city put together very, very well there. So they allowed high density along the transit lines, and they reserved many areas for restoring the creeks, for making public parks. They have many blocks of pedestrian streets that are entirely pedestrian. You just walk on them all over Curitiba. So it was one of the real great successes. But they assumed that they had the power to make some decisions. They made some of the decisions which were unpopular in the business community, such as closing streets, and then they succeeded because the closed streets actually worked quite well. And so Jaime Lerner got elected in the actual elections that came up in following years twice after that. And then he got to be governor of the state of Paraná because he was very successful with restructuring the city. So that was one odd sort of authoritarian case where you had some people come into power that really had a vision. And then you have in the United States, say, Portland, Oregon, which has many good policies that are coming online. And I think it has partially to do with the many years that Oregon itself was very concerned about environmental issues as a general attitude of the people of Oregon. And so they were actually looking about for better models of cities, and they have a bus system downtown, or a little sort of a trolley system that's completely free.
Mm-hmm.
They have much more mixed-use development going in now with more housing downtown. And they also have this project around a creek called Johnson Creek where they've been removing houses that are in a floodplain by a willing seller deal. In other words, if somebody wants to sell out, the city and FEMA funds pay for people to sell their property and leave. It's not eminent domain, but it's slowly getting people out of these areas that are intrinsically automobile dependent and also in harm's way, in the same sort of way that much of New Orleans has been built in harm's way.
Mm. Fascinating.
There's also the annual convergence that happens there.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, that it's a permaculturist from all over the place come in to... well, do you want to describe it from your point of view? How I see it is it's bringing many density clusters or creating public spaces where otherwise it would just be wasted lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments about that? Do you see that as
part
of the solution?
This event, which happens every year in Portland, is actually pretty inspiring, and people love to build things. And so one of the things that's been done there, a group called City Repair has pulled together a lot of neighborhoods to build on intersections where they close down an intersection and put up little gazebo-like affairs and benches and covered benches and trellises on arbors and so on that bring the neighbors out, and they build these wonderful expressions of what they want to build. And they also host mini talks. I've been a speaker there myself and put forward many really wonderful ideas in the context of Portland. These ideas are not in the neighborhood where they are doing the village convergence projects, shifting density much, though there is a policy in the city itself to create nodes of density into the future. So all these little pieces can add up there. But it's kind of slow, and the urban growth boundary has been set far enough out into the country that there's an awful lot of what looks like sprawl development going on there anyway. Curitiba has the problem that has built three automobile factories since 1990, and so they have a contradictory thing going there, and then Portland, Oregon has a urban growth boundary that's actually far out enough that it allows quite a bit of automobile-dependent development anyway. So you look for these little pieces, and you don't find much of where all the pieces come together.
It's a huge undertaking. We're about to run out of time on the show, and I still feel very much that it would be wonderful to be able to get these ideas across to more people. I think bringing people together is a major component. First of all, these changes can't happen without people working together. Mm-hmm. And starting out with just engendering enthusiasm for possibility is a great place. We've talked about having a slideshow presentation at Studio B where you'd be talking more about eco cities and what's possible and the positive benefits of them. And I'd like to invite our listeners to visit Richard's website. Mm-hmm. You can go ahead and give your URL.
It's ecocitybuilders.org, ecocitybuilders.org.
Great.
ecocitybuilders.org, and for information on future gatherings around this subject and St. Richard's slideshow, you can contact Studio B at 415-255-9794 or email pixlcam@copper.net. That's pixelcam@copper.net.
Great.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us, Richard.
You're welcome.
This is Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. You're listening to our radio show, Reality Sandwich. Stay tuned every Thursday. Thank you for listening.
Yeah.